Hey, Jeff, I think Jeff has an announcement.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess I did blog about that. We're having twins.
Hey.
Twin girls in February. Yeah, so we have one child who's 2.5. We're adding 2 more to the fold here. So the children will now officially outnumber us, which is definitely scary.
They're going to take over.
That is sort of like that Arthur C. Clarke childhood ends with the children's crusade, and it's scary. It's scary. They start marching around. They call the police on you. They might have to be a little bit older before they're going to start calling the police on you.
Yeah, it's glad to finally announce it, because twin pregnancies are riskier, plus we're a little bit older, so we want to make sure before we announce it that everything was absolutely going to go forward.
Right.
It's what you're supposed to do anyway, but we were being pretty cautious on this one. But yeah, it's looking very good, so.
Cool.
Congratulations. Yay.
Two more ladies in the world.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you scared?
Are you scared? Oh, you should be scared if you're having children. So yes, of course I am very scared. But you know, I think we know what we're doing. The first one is the unknown is the scariest thing there is, right? Like not knowing what's going to happen. And I think having your first child definitely knocks out a lot of the like what the hell is going on moments, right? Like you sort of know what to expect, and so we sort of have that in our back pocket. But then on the other hand, it is two at once.
and I think you even if you know what to expect, you know every kid is different, so. You know,
yeah,
it's
such a different experience. That's the paradox I was trying to capture in the blog post that I wrote. That it's this thing, it's this experience that everybody, well, not everybody, almost everybody has. It sort of binds
Many
you together,
people.
Regardless of culture, regardless of creed, regardless of opinions. You can sort of talk to somebody about their kids, you know? I mean, almost as long as you have language in common, I guess.
Yeah.
And yet, even though that's the case, it's still very, very different from person to person in how it happens and, you know, how you react to it and the cultural things around it.
What frightens me is like almost any arbitrary random lady that you see sitting on the bus is probably able to babysit your kids better than you can. You know, like you just know that like everybody that you see in real life can change their diapers and make them stop crying and give them their food and keep them.
Except for you.
Right. Well, you learn to do that stuff. But you know what's really one thing I didn't talk about in the blog post, because it's a little bit heavy, is that once you have a kid, you realize those feelings you have are so strong and they're so sort of out of left field. And you realize that like sort of every war that we have when people are killed, like that was someone's baby. You know, that was somebody's mother loved that child.
Yeah.
And now he's just, you know,
well,
he
not
or she's just
not
gone.
Russians. I mean,
not necessarily true.
Yeah.
Some
it could
people,
be orphans. They could be like the Batman, right?
Or just total a-holes.
Yeah.
Total a-holes. But it is sobering to think of every cost of war in terms of not just lives, but like babies.
Babies.
Like, it's just weird. Like everybody was a baby. Like, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but it does make war seem really, it almost makes you want to become a hippie and start to be very anti-war because every death has a heavy toll. Like, I mean, you imagine your children dying. That is like the worst. Like, we don't even joke about that. Like, it's not even funny. Because that's come up on Twitter once, and Jen was replying. He's like, yeah, it's like literally it's the worst thing I can think of.
I wonder if you know, there's a new book out that talks about how basically war has declined in the last few decades. And the other thing that's declined is the number of children that people have. So I wonder if you had like 12 children, you would start to feel differently about that.
You're like, yeah, there's a few extra in the
exactly.
batch.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, you know what we need? A good war right now.
to increase the number of children?
No, decrease. I'm saying if everyone starts having too many kids, like,
you'd be like,
oh, you know what we need?
War. You can take some of them off to war, yeah. Yeah, that was the first
also, the thing is, not only has the number of children been going down, but the number of children, like, dying in... Yeah. As infants have also been going down.
Infant mortality, that's right.
Way
and
down.
Also mortality of women giving childbirth is way down.
Right.
So, yeah, that part's good. And then how about, you know, instead of war, we just have virtual war. We can all play Battlefield 3, which just came out today, so I'm very excited about that.
Yeah.
How's that going so far?
I love it. It's great. In fact, right before this call, we were playing with some people from the Stack Exchange team. The team play support is great, but it's hard to keep everybody together. The game doesn't really do a good job of supporting... keeping everybody in the same squad.
You mean people?
But it's fun. Like
often.
I was running around. I was sort of teaching Nick Craver how to do stuff in the game. It was kind of fun. It's like, you know, go up here, spawn on me, and you know, it's about team play ultimately. I mean, a lot of these games, the reason they're fun, is because you know you're actually actively working towards a goal with other people. And if you read my gamification blog post, that was sort of the point of Stack Overflow, was to sort of, I don't want to say trick, but to get people to work together without necessarily trying to, you know, towards a goal. And I think the best games do that for you. Like, it's incentivizes working together to solve a problem. And I find that very, very enjoyable. And
the moments of cooperation are awesome.
Yeah, it is. You know, and you've never met these people, and yet here you are working towards this goal and, you know, having fun doing it.
Right.
And
right.
That's great.
And all the great community sites work that way.
It's Eric Reese. Yeah. Yay! Sorry, I just.
Eric Reese.
We haven't introduced you properly.
Everybody. Yeah, let's do an introduction for our guest, Joel.
That you're hearing here is Eric Reese, who is the associated most with the English word pivot. Which comes from the Lean Startup methodology. You have a new book out called, what's it called? Lean Startups. The Lean Startup?
The Lean Startup.
The Lean Startup. Your student originally going back of Steve Blank, I guess, who wrote this very kind of esoteric underground book called The Four Steps of the Epiphany, to the Epiphany? Which, like, nobody knows about, and it's just his typewritten class notes sort of stapled together and published in the form of a book, and it's kind of hard to get a hold of, and nobody's ever heard of it, and a couple of entrepreneurs were sort of passing it around, you know, secretly in Silicon Valley. You don't want too many people to find out about it, because then they'll know all the secrets of how to make an awesome product that people want. And some of those concepts, and some of your own, I think, have surfaced in the Lean Startup idea. Mm-hmm. What is a lean startup?
Well, yeah, what certainly was an underground phenomenon for a while. Yeah. We call it lean startup by analogy to this thing called lean manufacturing, you know, Toyota Production System, and this whole kind of system of management that was about fast cycle time and building quality in from the beginning and really being close to your customers to figure out what they want. And if you look at, like, most agile development systems, right, you know, they have their roots in this lean manufacturing approach.
So lean manufacturing, but, and one of the key things, correct me if I'm wrong, of the Toyota factory was this idea that instead of just kind of building it, like the Ford idea was you build it on an assembly line, and if anything goes wrong, do not stop the assembly line, because that's going to bring the whole factory to a halt. Just fix it afterwards. And so these cars would drive off at the end of the assembly line, and every single one of them would have four things wrong with it. And so you'd park them all over in a big area, and a bunch of high-paid mechanics would go around trying to fix all the things that had gone wrong. Mm-hmm. And then Toyota said, wait a minute, we got to stop the line if things go wrong. We should be producing things right in the first place. The cost of repairing, like if you put the wrong wheel on a car or something, then the next guy who has to put the cover over that wheel is going to have to hammer it into place and cause all kinds of expense and damage because you did it wrong the first time.
You got it right. And there's no chance you'll ever get to take... Somebody probably caused the problem originally. Like, there's some designer or engineer, you know, who set up the process wrong. Mm-hmm. How are you going to get that person feedback if the error is not discovered until, you know, thousands of steps later and everyone's blaming it on somebody else? And it's actually really a counterintuitive process.
Yep.
And it's actually hard for people to visualize, because it just seems like it would be inefficient to keep stopping the process all the time.
Yeah,
but actually, it's more efficient.
Stop this huge assembly line, right?
And I don't know if you guys have ever seen that one of the, like, famous, you know, lean teaching moments is they have this. You know, they'll have people do a simple task like taking envelopes and stuffing them with newsletters. You never had to do that task, right? You have a bunch of letters, you fold them all, then stuff them in envelopes, stamp them.
Yeah,
label,
I'm here at Stack Exchange. Has to do 20,000 of those a week. You thought those were automatically emailed out. But he actually...
No. Somebody has to physically fold them. Yeah. And if you ask, you know, if you ask even one of Jeff's children, or you ask any child, what's the most efficient way to do a task like that, everybody has a really strong and specific intuition about it, which is, if I have to do 100 letters, I should fold all 100, then stuff all the envelopes, then label them all, and kind of do it. We call it batch size 100, where you're passing 100 items from stage to stage. It's like classic waterfall development. It's like, do a month worth of features, and then we'll QA all the 1 month worth of features, and then we'll launch them all in one big batch. And it turns out that even for a task as simple as stuffing envelopes, if you do it in single piece flow, batch size one, which would mean literally you take one piece of paper, fold it, stuff it, label it, put the stamp on, seal it, stick it in the mailbox, and then do the second one.
Wait, you walk to the mailbox.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, hopefully you remove the transport batch and you locate yourself right next to the mailbox. But yeah, whatever your outbox is, that will send it to the next process. It takes you less time to do the whole task if you do it one thing at a time instead of 100 at a time. And nobody ever believes me when I tell them that, and it's too counterintuitive. No, it doesn't make sense.
Doesn't it depend on the task? I can think of lots of tasks where it's like, you know, if you're cleaning the house, you kind of want to do all the vacuuming at once because you just have the vacuum cleaner out.
Exactly. It actually depends on what they call the changeover time of the individual process. So how much Sure. Now, a big part of the lean manufacturing revolution was the discovery that if you have time to invest in your process, you're better off investing in reducing changeover time than you are at other kinds of efficiency gains. Because when you drive down changeover time, then you can drive down batch size. So all this manufacturing talk, I'm talking to entrepreneurs, are always like, well, what does this manufacturing stuff have to do with me? I'm trying to build this great new thing, and I want to make the next Facebook and whatever.
Yeah, we don't manufacture anything.
Right, we don't actually, I mean, we're trying to avoid manufacturing things as much as possible. What I think is really interesting is the question about, you know, all this discussion of lean manufacturing, it all presupposes that you know what your goal is, what you're trying to accomplish. You know who the customer is and what they would view as valuable, what their notion of quality is. And so everything's going to go right. And if anything deviates from the plan, we'll correct it really quickly. But going back to the, like, envelopes in a newsletter example, like, what if the envelopes don't seal? They're defective. When do you want to find that out? Do you want to find that out after you've stuffed all 100 of them? Or do you want to find it out after you have stuffed only one?
Yeah. Oh, good
point. And, you know, if you have the wrong postage on them, you know, when do you want to find it out? And so if you think about a process where something horrible, like something drastically wrong might happen, like, for example, nobody wants the newsletters because you have all the wrong addresses, or the thing you're selling actually is not valuable at all. The question is, when do you want to find that out? And what's the way we can get that information fastest? And so when we go into the domain of lean startup, what we're trying to do is take those techniques from lean manufacturing, but apply them in the really different domain, a domain where we actually don't yet know what we're trying to accomplish. We don't know who the customer is. We don't know what our product is yet. We only have theories. We have, you know, hypotheses, and we're trying to be more scientific about testing those hypotheses to discover what's true. Anyway, that's what lean startup's all about.
Cool. So, I mean, you know, one part of it, I think, is the idea of not spending too much time making something until you actually have talked to, you know, gotten out there, talked to customers.
Well, just showing off what you've done. I mean, often you don't know what the reaction is going to be. You don't know if you've even built the correct thing until you sort of give it to someone and they try it. And one thing that I constantly lecture people about, specifically to programming, is this idea of really fast turnaround on fixing things and improving things. Like, we try to deploy Stack Exchange every day, like literally every day. We roll out something that has some kind of improvement or bug fix in it.
Yeah.
And I feel very strongly about that. And this idea that, when, for example, like, if there's an actual bug, the measurement I don't care about is, like, how many bugs are there. I actually don't care. I don't want there to be a lot, and I don't want them to be killing children, obviously. really bad bugs that are, well, that's my euphemism.
Maybe other people's children.
That's our theme of the day. Jeez.
It is.
Well, that's my euphemism. Yeah, exactly. That's my euphemism for really bad bugs that are, like, preventing major things. Like, nobody can post a question on Stack Overflow.
Right.
Actually, that might be nice for a day. you see my point. But the measurement that I care about is not so much bugs and severity of bugs, but how fast can we turn around and fix them and improve things. That's, I care intensely about that. And I'm constantly sort of optimizing for that, because I feel like that's what makes things work, is this rapid
changing of things rapidly.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the practices from Lean Startup is this thing we call continuous deployment, which is basically taking continuous integration to the next level, where like at my last company, InView, we would deploy to production about 50 times a day on average. That means as soon as you write software, you put it in trunk, 20 minutes later, it's live in production.
Yeah, it's old news to us.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, I'm sure, are doing way more advanced than that, I'm sure.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far. I mean, we do try to limit major. Well, to be honest, we deploy multiple times a day sometimes. But ideally, we deploy once or twice a day.
Why?
And you queue up sort of one day's worth of stuff. It gets tricky if everybody's changing everything, and because you kind of want, like, some time when you're watching the system after you push these things out. And if things are sort of going out at all times during the day, it's hard to sort of coordinate watching the system.
Let me give you a specific example. Oh yeah, please, let's do it.
So things that have gone wrong would be, somebody makes a change, they think it's not a big change. You know, maybe it's possible unit test, maybe it isn't. But it goes out, and it turns out this causes a crippling problem. Well, if it goes out sort of at a random time, when sort of the person who cares most about the change is the person who owns it. You know, I mean, we're aware of the changes, but the general feeling on our team is you own the changes you make. Like, you're responsible for shepherding them through the life of the site. So if that person isn't around, we don't know. Like, I have to go in and look at, say, something, not to pick on Ben, but Ben checks in something. This is just a completely arbitrary example. I'm not picking on Ben.
And,
you know, Ben's
Mark.
In Germany. So he's on a different schedule than us. So if it goes out, like, say now, he's not available. So then I would have to go figure it out, right? Which I can do.
That's a perfect argument for doing it in single piece flow rather than in batch size of one day's worth of work all at once. Because if changes go out as soon as they're made, that's the best time for the person, you know, person who just made the change is definitely going to be available because they're there. And of course, it requires you to build some infrastructure. If there's a catastrophic problem with a change, you don't want a human being in that decision loop. You actually want automated tests in production that can say, wait a minute, something's gone horrifically wrong. Let's automatically revert that change and stop the assembly line, just like in Toyota Production System.
I think we're kind of saying the same thing. It's really a question of, like, should we deploy hundreds of times a day? That might be a little crazy, right? How about if we deploy
single piece flow, and then however many changes you make, you deploy that number of times?
Yeah, I think there's it's just a question of degrees. And then as far as testing goes, I don't know. It's tough. I mean, ideally, yes, you want certainly sanity checks around, I think, the most important parts of the system that need to be working all the time. But there's so many things, like, depend on the browser's DOM. Like, how do you unit test that? Like, the flow of JavaScript against the client's browser? I don't know.
You guys tell me if you want. I mean, listen, I'd love to try to convince you to do this right now, but you guys tell me if this is what you want to spend the podcast talking about. But I'm happy to address those questions.
We're sort of a lean podcast, so we can change according to the market.
We don't need to take a quick
vote here from our customers. And if you want to keep talking about that.
Most people find what I'm suggesting crazy.
And that's
like totally fine. And actually, someone's already there on the chat saying there's exactly that same thing. But that's okay, because our intuitions about what's efficient for development all have this large batch legacy of the way that we were all trained. So this is a very common issue that we have to fight against. And it turns out that there are problems that you can't catch with unit testing. And so if you want to do continuous deployment, you have to build this thing we call the cluster immune system, where you're actually monitoring not just your technical but your business metrics in real time to detect if you've made a catastrophic mistake. And then you can actually build an immune system that automatically rejects changes that are no good and then do the shutdown the line. That's like the beginning of a process where every time you make a mistake, then it kind of triggers you to then invest in saying, well, how do we prevent that mistake from happening? And that can help you develop not just more robust unit tests, but these more in-production real-time tests that can, like, take your level of fear about someone accidentally taking the site down from, you know, it's probably not going to happen to, it would actually be really difficult to accidentally take the site down because our system is so robust. That's the development environment we built at InVue, and I'm a big believer that everybody can get there.
That's not the way Facebook works, though, for example. I mean, so much of their stuff is just broken, like, out of the box.
All the time. I mean, it's continuously broken.
Yeah, and to be completely honest with you, Eric, they don't care.
Yeah.
They literally don't care. Because...
Right.
It's not breaking an important part of the system, right? It's not breaking the ability of someone's grandmother to upload a photo to the site. And that's kind of the way I look at this.
Although, based on the email we get, it probably does occasionally.
Yeah,
no, but for 99.99%, it always fulfills the core function of, I can go on and stalk pretty girls that I know.
These things are complicated enough. Like, these systems are large enough and complicated enough, have enough moving parts. And the area of code that you're working on is usually so small that it starts to behave a lot more biologically than the programs of the old days. Like, you know, the programs that you wrote in computer science class 10 years ago, you would make one mistake, you'd leave out one semicolon, and it just would completely not work, and it would be catastrophic. And nowadays, it's like you could leave out a semicolon, the whole thing could not compile. Even if it deploys, now you have one tiny little section on the web page that doesn't display. Everything else works fine. In other words, we build these systems that are so large that they become relatively immune to large-scale problems. Not always. But they start
The analogy of an immune system of like that actually, I think, is because our systems are so organic, it's actually helpful if the person who wrote – it's the same logic that makes unit testing a win if you do it right. The person who wrote the feature can also then say, well, what's my immune response automatic thing that happens in production to tell me this feature stops working? And as soon as it stops working, the moment someone made the mistake, within 20 minutes of them making the mistake, we can immediately say, hey, did you know you broke this unrelated thing way over here. And then
our immune system
is
an email address, team@stackoverflow.com.
That's right. You're making your customers do it for you.
That's okay. Those are not our customers. Wait. Those are not our customers.
Yeah. If you're not paying, you're not the customer. You're the product.
I see. You have your product do it for you.
Kind of. I mean, this is a community-generated site, and part of what the community does is they tell us when we're screwing up.
I bet they don't mind catching new problems. What probably drives them crazy is when you make the same mistake over and over again.
Eric, let me clarify on that, because that surprised me. Because one of my big things that I get pissed off about is when we have bugs that come back. And yeah. I got to be honest with you, that is so rare. It happens, but regressions are just not that common. Like, it's good. I think to Joel's point, like, the system is so large and complex that, like, when you have problems, they're almost always like new problems you haven't seen before.
We do have a different situation, actually, which I have now seen since one of the products that I sell these days is a 10-year-old code base or an 11-year-old. Geez, heck, 15 years, depending on how far you go back, but a very, very old code base. And it's gotten to the point where nobody who's working on it really knows what it does or what it's supposed to do. And they will make changes that will break things that we fixed years and years ago, and they won't even know. Like,
a good argument.
And it won't be something that an automated test will necessarily get. Like, for example, you know, we just went through an episode where some, let's say, relatively new people to the team made some changes that would have improved the product in UI design, but would have confused established users, and they really weren't the right bang for the buck. So at one point, they rearranged six fields on the screen into a different order that they thought was more logical. And I was like, you guys don't know this, because this is before you started working here, but we had a two-day smash-down huge fight over the order of those six fields. And it turns out that this is the only possible order those six fields can be in. And I have no friggin' idea why. But it was a two-day fight, I remember, so please don't just randomly reorder six fields. I don't know if I would have thought to unit test the order of those six fields, and if anybody then saw that unit test, they'd be like, oh, well, that's obviously obsolete because I'm moving them around. So one thing that Stack doesn't have is it's still got the original people working on it that worked on it from the beginning. And we still kind of know the original, you know, the intention, why things work the way they work. And there is no – I think that there is still a lot of – fiction around this idea that you can have unit tests that enforce why you design things the way that they were, or that anything can be written in the form of documentation about how things work certain ways.
But I do agree with Eric that you should fix your pain points. I'm very adamant about, like, where we're seeing pain. Like, and I define pain as, like, things people are complaining about, of course, and of course, like, problems that keep recurring. So those definitely, like, we need to have a deeper process around, like, why is this problem keep happening? That this is starting to piss me off. But honestly, yep, like, a lot of those aren't our problem. Like, one problem that came back that wasn't our fault, there's a bug in .NET 4.0 that basically causes a server to go offline, one of our web tier servers, which is kind of traumatic. It just came back because what happened is we got a hotfix from Microsoft to fix this bug in .NET 4.0. It only happens under a really heavy load on websites. And they did a Windows update, and the Windows update overwrote the fix, the hot fix that they had given us, right? So that's an example of, yes, that problem sucks. And it's also very traumatic because it takes a web server out of rotation. So that kind of stuff I feel very strongly about. But for us, like, usually those problems are not our problems. I don't see a lot of recurring problems. But where I do, I totally agree with you that, you know, put a process in place. Why does this problem keep happening? What can we do to, you know, make it never happen again? I'm totally down with that.
So, and
one final clarification. We do actually deploy multiple times per day. I didn't mean literally once per day.
It's not like we have a 2 o'clock deploy or anything.
I tend to like deploying, like, at night Pacific for sure every day. And then beyond that, people can deploy, like, as they feel it's necessary. I don't know if I would support hundreds of times a day, but we have certainly have had days where we've deployed 12 to possibly 20 times. So I just want to be clear that I'm not a strict one deployment a day guy. So we're kind of meeting in the middle there.
Hey, yeah, Jeff, you know,
I can live with that.
Jeff, I just told the core team, the fact that you even know about that hotfix means I'm adding 30 minutes onto your vacation at the end. You're supposed to be on vacation. You're not supposed to know about that shit.
Well, it came up in Battlefield, actually, because in the voice chat, they were like, oh my God, that stupid hash table thing is back. Okay. And I was like, everybody groaned collectively, right? It's like, why does this keep happening?
Jeff is officially on vacation, so every time he dabbles in work, I add time onto the end of his vacation.
You're fired from being able to come back to work.
I want to talk a little bit more about lean startups, because I have a criticism of the lean startups. It's not a criticism of lean startups, actually. It's that there's been this combination of lean startups. Oh, boy. Somebody's going to know who I'm talking about, including you, Eric. This combination of lean startups combined with the fact that any startup can get $750,000 in funding instantly just by, like, batting their eyelashes means that there's a lot of kind of startups that are pivoting an awful lot. Or they're failing to pivot, or they're essentially
they're just awful ideas from the beginning, but it's like, no, we can take $500,000 that someone will give us and we'll just figure out
later. We'll work on it for three. Or I'll take a very public example, just based on the publicly available information, was this startup called Color, which received, I think, $40 million, $50 million in Sequoia funding. Based on kind of a business plan and a little app that they had done, sort of like Marimba 10 years later. And having this sort of all-star team of three very famous people, two of whom quit. And their app was just not a good app, and nobody used it, didn't work, didn't have traction, there was no market there. And I think they've pivoted at least once to some completely different idea that is also not that original. And then you start wondering, is this team going to come up with a good idea or not? And you'll kind of never know. The word pivot, I think, is used to mean change business plan rather than...
Oh, yeah. It's a mess. I mean, and look, we're going through the summer years of entrepreneurship right now. And I always say in my public talks, like, winter is coming.
Yeah.
So, some of this nonsense is going to go away because it is cyclical.
It's the same thing you say to the Occupy Wall Street people. It's like, it's a lot of fun now, but just wait until it's... 12 degrees below.
You think it's bad now. It could get a lot worse. and the startup economy cannot remain divorced from the real economy indefinitely. So, we got to get involved with those issues. But on the specific issue of people overusing the word pivot, I just want to say, first of all, for the record, what is a pivot? A pivot is a change in strategy without a change in vision. So that's the first thing. People who are pivoting all the time are not accomplishing anything because they're just like making changes to their product or just kind of randomly jumping around.
Just doing a different product every time.
Yeah, just doing something different. It's like, well, that's just, you're either just optimizing your existing product or you're like giving up on your vision and just hopping to a new one every 2 seconds. You can't learn anything. The heart of lean startup is all about learning. You can't learn anything if you don't have a specific hypothesis.
You've thrown away all this learning essentially. And now you're kind of casting around for
something else. And we use the analogy of the pivot is supposed to be 1 foot anchored, one other moving at a time. So it's always rooted in what you've learned so far. And if you look at the PayPal, the Groupon, or Microsoft, or any of these famous stories of companies that started in doing one thing and wound up doing something else, it always kind of makes sense in retrospect. You can kind of see the thread of vision. But if you were there at the time, my favorite is Groupon right now, because Groupon, when they finally made the pivot into social commerce, their MVP, their minimum viable product, was they set up a WordPress blog called Groupon, and they offered a coupon for 2-for-1 pizza off the pizza restaurant in the lobby of their building.
Okay.
20 people redeemed the coupon. So they gave away 20 free pizzas, and they like literally were on their laptop in Apple Mail, like making the PDFs, individually emailed all 20 people their coupon. And I always tell people, like, I know if you were there, I'm not smart enough, but if you were there, you would have been like, oh, 20 free pizzas? Obviously, fastest company in history to have $1 billion in sales. Of course, like, what a good idea, it's so obvious. But it's only because they had the year of failure building that crappy thing called The Point that didn't work that they really understood how hard it is to get 20 people to do basically anything at all, let alone go collect the 20 pizzas. And that put them on a path to kind of make sense in retrospect. You kind of see, they were doing this petition social advocacy thing, and now they're doing social commerce. You can kind of see the thread. But if you were there in the moment, it can be hard to understand what's happening. If you're outside of it, it doesn't.
There doesn't always have to be a thread. Like, the famous examples are like Blogger, which started out as Pyra Labs, which is doing project management, but then they needed an internal blog tool, so they threw something together. And Fog Creek, which was doing consulting, but we needed bug tracking. We had that thing. We started selling it. And the pivot there was just that you're doing three things at once, and you pick the one that's actually really successful, and then you kind of move all your resources behind that.
Yeah.
And that may feel like a pivot because now you're going in a different direction. But essentially, you're just choosing winners. You do several things early on. You pick the ones that win.
Right, but at least there you're doing things that are in your expertise that you already have experience doing. There are companies that go bizarre and are just like, okay, what we're doing isn't working right now. Let's just create something entirely different that we have no experience or no expertise and no tie to.
Or no reason for winning, yeah. And nobody can stop them from doing that because it sounds cool.
Right, as long as it sounds cool.
It's got the pivot word behind it. And because they have money. Like, nobody can tell them what to do or what not to do because they've raised enough money to keep going for another 2 years.
Well, and the money thing is really a problem because I call it success theater, which is the work you do to make yourself seem successful. and every ounce of energy that we as an ecosystem invest in success theater is an ounce of energy we could have invested in doing real work for customers to actually creating value. And we chose not to the success theater.
It's like recruiting your board of advisors.
Define success theater. What's an example?
So success theater, like, the reason that certain people are able to raise a ton of money for nothing, for like having no idea, no plan, no like – no product, no traction, no nothing, but they can still raise these ridiculous rounds.
Oh, I see.
Is because they're able to put on a show for investors that make them look and feel like a superstar success that these investors have seen in the past. It's a bug in the fact that most VCs are doing pattern recognition, and pattern recognition is just a fancy word for bias.
Yeah.
They have a bias for a certain set of people that kind of look and feel and smell and talk like a visionary success. So they're looking for the guy who looks like Steve Jobs looked when he first walked in his office, or Larry and Sergey, or any of these famous entrepreneurs. So if you have the look and if you know how to put on the right kind of show, you can raise a lot of money basically for free.
And but wait, isn't that based on track record? I mean, so if you say you had three successful startups or two or whatever the number is, I mean, isn't it fair to say, okay, this person has a track record of success?
It may just be that you worked for Facebook.
Yeah.
Well, right. You could have gotten lucky. Fine. Okay. Well, that's why the data point should be bigger than one. But if someone's had two, maybe three successful startups, isn't that a reasonable argument to use?
Well, it also depends what's a successful startup and what was their role in it.
But wait a minute. That's what happened to Color, essentially, is that Sequoia said, I don't care how stupid your idea is or successful.
Yeah, you guys,
I want to give you so much
successful
money that I get to invest in all your future startups. Like, I'm already invested in them. And you'll just sit there and you'll just knock out idea after idea after idea, and one of them will eventually work. And then I don't have to invest then because I will have prepaid for my ownership of all your future startups.
Just because a process or a system has bias in it doesn't mean that it's 100% unfair. I mean, it's still fair. Yeah. It's perfectly. These are all private capital. They can invest it where they want. But we don't have a better system yet for assessing objectively which startups are actually making progress and which ones are just doing the success theater. So that's why people are constantly focusing on the vanity metrics, right?
At the early stage, that's true. Yeah, and the trouble is that VCs are forced nowadays to invest earlier than they used to. Because otherwise they won't have a chance to get in, and before there are signs of traction.
Yeah, and I think that we can do better than that. I mean, part of the thing I argue for in my book and spend a lot of time trying to develop is I call it innovation accounting because it needs a name, and which is just basically an alternate accounting system that is designed to tell if you're getting closer to this thing we call product market fit in an early stage company, way before the vanity metrics are going to be large enough to tell anybody that there's real success. Right. So if you think about the pivot from Odeo into Twitter.
Yeah,
you know, when they had something like 300 or 400 customers,
that was a restart, wasn't it? I mean, there was nothing between Odeo and Twitter. There are no two things in common. The founders of those two products hated each other and fought like cats and dogs over which direction to go in.
And in fact, when they had their like very earliest customers, we shouldn't even call it customers, they weren't paying, very earliest users in the product, the numbers were so small, they went back to a bunch of their investors and offered them their money back.
Yeah.
Said, listen, you don't have to invest in this Twitter thing. It doesn't seem like it's going that well. And a bunch of investors made the billion-dollar mistake of saying, yes, thank you. Take my money back. But now a lot of them feel quite bitter about it, of course.
Isn't the cynical view on that they knew this was going to be bigger and saw an opportunity to own a bigger piece of it?
I've heard that. So the question is, how come the entrepreneur, if you believe in that theory, the cynical theory or the ignorant theory is the same question to me, which is, how is it possible that the investors, the supposedly savviest ones, given the data that they had available to them, couldn't see what the insiders could see? Why do the insiders believe when the investors didn't? The answer is that the insiders knew to look not at the vanity metrics, the gross numbers of customers, but rather the per customer engagement numbers, which were off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
And yet all of us who are in this ecosystem, we're all still generally trained to use traditional accounting metrics, ROI, profitability, growth rates, the kind of stuff that doesn't matter for an early stage company. I think if we as an ecosystem could adopt a better set of analytics around what constitutes progress, one that's denominated in validated learning, that's about demonstrating scientifically that you're getting closer to product market fit. Because right now we think of it as like totally binary, you either have it or you don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll be able to make the investment process in early stage companies much more meritocratic and much less biased. So I mean, I think as an ecosystem, it's a really important change. It's just going to take a little while.
So here's our pivot at – we don't really have a pivot at Stack Overflow at Stack Exchange. But we've always assumed that we need to get from the community of programmers to other communities that have questions and answers. And the examples that we give, both because they're awesome and because that's it's sort of an end goal for us, is medical research, right? So we think that there are all these medical researchers, MD, PhDs sitting there in pharmaceutical companies, in research institutions like Rockefeller University and the National Institute of Health, and they're sitting around doing research on medical problems. And they are, as far as we can tell, not using anything even remotely like Stack Exchange to right. help each other with their research problems. They're just sort of a little bit behind the times. And the question is, how do you get to them? And that's kind of hard. And there's a very fundamental problem with the Stack Exchange model that there's a critical mass. You need 200 people on a site before it starts to work. We can't make it work with three people, and then hopefully we'll get four people tomorrow. It just doesn't have that same critical massiness. So we've always thought, listen, the way we're going to solve this is by what we call the overlapping circles idea, which is we have the circle of programmers that happens to not overlap with medical researchers at all.
No. Kevin Bacon. Come on.
Kevin Bacon. Six degrees of Kevin Bacon. Better than overlapping circles.
Yeah, yeah.
6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. So the programmers don't overlap at all, but they do overlap with, and this is what we said when we were raising funds, we said, but a lot
this
of programmers.
This has the ring of a good pitch to it.
Yeah, but a lot of programmers are also photographers and chefs. So let's take the photographers and the chefs, and let's make a site for cooking and photography, and the programmers will come in there, but eventually they will start to attract people who are just plain old photographers, don't know anything about programming, and those people, which we call civilians because they're not programmers in our internal definition, the civilians, some of them may be medical researchers, and eventually there will be enough of those people to say, hey, let's make a medical research site. And that's the overlapping circles idea about how we branch essentially into other verticals. Mm-hmm. That's the theory.
You know, the thing that surprised me, Joel, is it's a little bit like founding a religion, too, in some ways, because you want people to believe that there's actually a better way, right? Like, we have the forum way, we have the traditional way of disseminating this information, but it's hugely, hugely flawed. And you have to get people to believe that, basically, that there's something better than the current sort of belief systems that are on the internet.
Yeah.
And because it takes a lot of work. I mean, it's the path of least resistance is to do the traditional forum. And it works it works well enough that you can sort of point at it and say, oh, well, this has the information. It's a little work to get it out, yes. And the UI is terrible and nobody can ever find anything. But hey, it kind of works, right? Yeah. And you can have discussions about your favorite, you know, color of syringe.
And you can
tell
lots of exciting stories about your success rate of 20% of getting answers to your questions.
Right, because that's state of the art.
Yeah.
And what you guys are describing is straight out of Jeff Moore. I mean, you know, after you cross the chasm, then you have you know, Paul Bowling Alley theory where the, you know, to get mainstream customers, you can't get everybody all at once. You got to find groups of mainstream customers who view your previous successes as validation and not alienation. And then, you know, as you rack up more wins, that helps you kind of go to the next level of early mainstream, et cetera. Right. And, you know, it's to get to medical researchers is probably going to be several links in the chain.
So one of the interesting things that happened is we were saying photography and cooking just because, you know, that's what we randomly thought. And indeed, those sites exist. We have 60 odd sites. But the one which seems right now poised to get us over the gap is gaming, believe it or not, which is not a site that we're super duper excited about because it's not something you do at work. You never really need to know the answer. I mean, it's a game.
Hold on, back up.
So,
how many games are you playing?
I know, but you know, the site is extremely helpful. I could not have gotten through Call of Duty, Black Ops or whatever it's called, without it. Or Angry Birds 3-15. So, it has saved
314.
My...
314.
315.
Well, you know, look it up, Alex. Joel, I had another observation to make about gaming. Now, I've been, I love gaming and I love games, but I'm.
Yeah, that's what we say. We're always like, we love games, but.
I mean, I was playing Battlefield right before this call, so believe me, when I say love games, I mean it. I really love games.
Yeah.
But let me give you an example. Like, so I've been following Battlefield 3, and I've gotten a little obsessive about it. So I went to the subreddit, which I hadn't spent, I mean, I spend some time on Reddit, but I had never really spent a lot of time on a subreddit. Now, there's some direct analogs here to some of the stuff we're doing, right? Like, there's a cooking site, there's a photography site, there's the site for programmers, there's the site for system administrators. Well, there's a place you go on Reddit. It's reddit.com/r/Battlefield3, and it's sort of everything Battlefield 3, and it's a filtered view of the topic. And one of the things that struck me about the gaming site, this is one of my criticisms, is generally the people who are into games like are really into certain games. You know, this idea of being a generalist, like when we look at Server Fault, and Stack Overflow, what we said was the best programmers are kind of generalists. Like, they know multiple languages, they have interest in like regular expressions and stuff like that, which tend to be a concept that's expressed in multiple, like, you know, lambdas and things like that.
Yep.
These exist across multiple languages, but I don't think you can really, and even for sysadmins, it's a much more segmented
set yeah, you of like fields, the, like the Cisco world and the Novell world and the NT world.
But you can make a credible case. You can make a credible case that a good sysadmin actually knows Linux and Windows. I mean, kind of. I mean, it makes sense. But can you really make the case that like a person who loves Battlefield is going to love, say, Minecraft or, you know, or like there's some of these games honestly bore me to tears.
I'm bored to tears by Java and I still go on Stack Overflow. So
true. But do we even have anything in common?
Right.
Like, I mean, Minecraft is a game of creation. It's not a game of, as I like to say, blowing shit up. Like, honestly, I like to blow shit up. And the type of people who like that not at all like the type of people. They're like, oh, I'm going to spend 3 hours mining for this crazy ore. I mean, God, I mean, seriously, kill me now. Like, I can't take it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't mean they're wrong.
This is sort of weird. Argument, I mean, Jeff, last weekend I went to watch the, or 2 weekends ago, it was Major League Gaming. And the games were StarCraft, which is mining a bunch of gold, Call of Duty, which is just a first-person shooter, and one more thing. I don't remember what the third one was. But it was games that you might think are relatively – well, it was a sports game, I think, actually. So games that you would think are kind of far apart, and yet they sort of all came together in this Major League Gaming thingamajiggy. Anyway, the only I want to finish the story, though. The end of the story is that we just look at statistics. We don't know. We made 60-something odd sites. How many do we have on Stack Exchange right now? Stack Exchange.
66.
66, really? We should have a Route 66, like a little party for the whole, you know, get your kicks on Route 66. That site is not displaying for me. StackExchange.com/sites.
It's okay.
68.
Apple is doing better.
Some of them are doing pretty well. Yeah, Apple, Android's Ubuntu really are doing pretty well. But gaming is doing nicely, and it's growing pretty well. And we believe now, actually, that it's got this remarkable overlap between programmers, tons of whom play games, and civilians.
That's very true.
So it's likely to be an excellent bridge thing. And it's not anything we could have predicted in advance or that we knew was going to be worth betting on. But when we allowed 66 sites to get created, one of them is just sort of emerging as likely to be a very, very good bridge site. So we're going to kind of invest in it as such. In other words, try to figure out, like, all right, what do we have to do to make gaming grow and more awesome?
And to go back to my earlier analog, so I think Reddit is also attempting to cross the chasm, as you say, with the subreddits. And there's like a billion of these subreddits.
Yeah. They're the big hidden secret behind. That's why Reddit has so much traffic.
And there's also the other secret is there's a lot of adult subreddits.
There might be some female breasts on Reddit somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I like
possible.
Reddit.
It's possible.
Any
I'm not
tool
sure.
on the internet will at some point be used for pornography.
Or for emailing pornography, right? Wasn't that the technical law?
Every tool will in some way be used to spread pornography.
I don't know. Not Stack Exchange.
Well, human beings.
At some point it will be.
You should not dare the internet.
I dare you.
We do have the human sexual response proposal.
Yeah, exactly. That's going to be
thank
so
and
clinical.
Someone is going to be like, I'm trying this. Here's a picture of what I'm trying to do.
Okay, I'm rolling that back in. I'm pulling that back in. I was just using that as an example, but Joel, if you're looking at example something, it started out very geeky, right? Reddit is still actually extremely geeky. I think we've been slightly more successful at being less geeky, but it's still tough. And I think the Reddit model is a good one because I was enjoying this Battlefield 3 Reddit. I don't like some aspects of it because there's a lot of noise on Reddit. In my
opinion. They're a lot like forums. There's a little bit of voting. A lot of them are used as Q&A if you go into certain obscure ones.
Right. There's a bunch of Q&A. In fact, I asked a Q&A because I needed to – I was doing a little Battlefield 3 giveaway. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out how to do that digitally. You know, what's the easiest – the most sensible way to get a digital copy of a game to someone because it's not on Steam, which is the obvious choice for most gamers. Mm-hmm. And I got a really good answer, actually. So it did work for me with that. And it is a weird mixture of sort of links to other stuff and like what they call self questions of like just tell me some thing about the game I have some question about.
Some of the people in the chat room mentioned that the hardcore gamers tend to play a lot of games. It's really the casual gamers who just pick one thing that they like Minecraft or Sims or whatever. Those are what they consider casual gamers. But the hardcore gamers, and I think I agree with this, they play a lot of games. They play every game that comes out when it comes out until they're bored with it. And the hardcore gamers will even play a remarkable amount of Angry Birds, you know, when they're just sitting on the subway with their iPhone.
I love Angry Birds.
You're not a hardcore gamer.
I know, but I still love Angry Birds.
I don't know.
I think it's just everybody loves Angry Birds.
Another two miles away from the microphone.
It didn't deliver the depth of obsession I needed at all. It was much more of a generalist, and it covers You know how, okay, the classic argument for sight is how much of the front page do you object to? This tells you if you're in the right place. Yeah. When I go to gaming, I object to a lot of the front page. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying I think that's going to be pretty typical.
Yeah.
That you're
that's
gonna
actually
go
one
there
of the things
like,
that we're working
this
on.
This sucks. Like I actively object to these things existing on this site.
So what did we talk about this last week on the podcast? There's some stuff where basically just the tags are kind of in the wrong order, so we can't really make a good... I mean, like, there's a lot of Pokemon stuff going on here, for one. Jesus.
Well, the big problem is we're saying, like, strategy as the first tag instead of the name of the game
Tag. So, for example, there should be a Diablo 2 homepage. There should be a Call of Duty kind of homepage that feels like Call of Duty.
When I was playing World of Warcraft obsessively, I only wanted to go to the WoW wiki. Yeah, I did not want to be on any kind of general gaming site. That's not where the people I want to talk to.
Yeah, WoW is
and
a little bit.
That's exactly my point.
But we can effectively turn all of our tag wiki pages into that, those pages.
Yes. To those home pages, yeah.
Like, I mean, the technology for that. We just need
a
few tweaks.
We have the technology.
Yeah.
But I would say that, you know, going all the way back to the topic of Pivot, you know, since I'm Mr.
Sure.
Pivot.
Yeah.
Do
you ever get bored with that? Do you ever get bored being Mr.
Pivot? I just got over it eventually. I'm sorry. You know what? Fine. We're just gonna talk about it.
It's like William Shatner. It's like people still say beam me up, Scotty, to William Shatner when he's walking around.
Once you have people like saying that to you on the street, you have to be like, you know what? That's just how it is. Okay. Yeah. I accept it. So yes, I will accept all Pivot jokes at all times. But people think of a pivot like as being a mistake or a failure, because often in the early stages that's how it manifests. But it's actually not necessarily a mistake.
No.
If you think of the stages in Crossing the Chasm and the Bowling Alley and all those like cute names that Jeff Moore has, like all of those are pivots. Because what you realize is that what used to work for you, the strategy you used to be pursuing, like was working great. And let's just imagine that your mainstream customers, they don't think of themselves as generalists. Like that could be a classic like idiosyncratic Asperger's Z programmery thing to do, where it's like generalism is good, whereas maybe gamers or some other group is like, no, generalism is stupid. Like they don't have anything in common with people just because we both play games. That's dumb. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really matter what you guys think. And it doesn't really matter what I think. Yeah. It matters only what the people whose behavior you're trying to change, what they think.
Yeah.
So you may, you know, as you get to more and more mainstream customer segments, have to really change what the model is in order to be able to repeat it successfully.
Well, I can certainly see that's a compelling argument for basically the filtered view of the site. That I really only want to see that subset of the game that I'm currently obsessing over.
That is true. That's what David pointed out. I don't know if he did it on the podcast, but he said if you are playing a game, you will go on to Stack Exchange. You'll want to see all questions about that game and just read them all because that's fun, which you're very rarely going to go on to Stack Overflow and say, I want to see all the JavaScript questions and just sit there and read them.
Some people do actually do that, Joel. I mean, I've had people come up to me at the dev days and said they just went through a tag and they were learning. So they would try to answer every question, look at every question on that particular tag. So it does happen.
Yeah.
But you may need
more structure also. Like, you know, I could, you know, especially in a game that's laid out in a linear fashion, you may need to... It may not count. It may not be good enough just to show people a filtered view. They might still have that feeling of being a second-class citizen, or like this isn't a site for me, and they may still want to go to a site where, like, from top to bottom, where it's branded, what it's called, like says, you are like this is the Call of Duty place. Like, come here.
That's the classic argument for the way we launch sites. I mean, that's why we have the cooking site looks like a place for cooks. So I can see that point as well. It's tough. It's just, you know, how do you draw the line? And you know, it's in different places for different people, but. For me, with gaming, I feel kind of very strongly that you tend to pick a certain game that you're into and you obsess over it for a while. You may move on to other games, but during that period, it's like I really only want to see...
It's your primary game.
I mean, I could see like, okay, I'm a shooter fan, right? I play Battlefield 3. So I don't object to seeing stuff about other shooters. Like, I don't necessarily object to Call of Duty appearing in my stream, but, you know, Pokemon, I kind of object to.
Well, and if you think about the game elements of Stack Exchange, like the badges and the levels and the points, like the big question is, does somebody who is obsessed with Call of Duty, will they see someone who gained their status through Pokemon questions as legitimately having the same level as them? And if the answer to that question is no, then it's fundamentally not going to work to have them be in the same ranking system. But if the answer is yes, then it probably will work. That's where I would that's the focal point I would be fixated on.
Hmm.
Just to be clear, I think this is most endemic on gaming. There's stuff about gaming that makes this a particular problem there. I'm looking at our site list. I don't think there's any other site where I feel that this is... I think this is really unique, in my opinion, to gaming.
Well, gaming, we tried to make it a relatively wide ecumenical site for all gamers, which we never... I don't think we ever did that with any other... But you're not noticing it, but it happens on answers.onstartups.com, and one of the reasons why that site is sometimes weird is because you get somebody trying to set up a beauty salon in Zimbabwe, and you know I don't know.
Right. It's pretty broad.
It is a startup.
Oh yeah,
but so
well, again, you know, is it a profession? I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, I don't want to rehash stuff. I like gaming. Gaming is cool. It's an experiment. We're running an experiment. I will continue to ask and answer, you know, Battlefield, whatever games I'm actually playing, I will certainly talk about there.
One of the things that's interesting, Jeff, about Reddit is that they do pretty well with really tiny subreddits that have like 3 people participating in them and get 1 post every month. Not that they do well, but I mean, they sort of survive.
They
turn over. Yeah. And that allows them to have kind of a lot more granularity of conversation. So if you just become a mega Reddit fan, you suddenly realize, wait a minute, there's going to be a Reddit for my thing. Mm-hmm. And you'll go in there and you'll find the 2 other people talking about quilting, and you'll be the 3rd person to talk about quilting, and you'll have a lot of fun talking about quilting on Reddit. And whereas we have such a long process before we would allow anybody to talk about quilting, just to make sure that there's going to be a good conversation.
Yeah, critical mass is, you know, the Area 51 process.
Somebody in the chat room asks if we've ever considered splitting up games or startups. That is one of the problems that we have. I think I wrote both blog posts. Like one blog post I wrote said your site should be really broad, and the other one said your site should be really narrow. And our biggest problem is trying to figure out what the right scope for a site is. And I think that the best answer that we follow these days is if you can imagine an encyclopedia of X, then that would be it. So there is an encyclopedia of gaming, not a book. So if it's book-length material, like there is a book about Call of Duty, but there wouldn't be
That's
an encyclopedia
small.
Of Call of Duty, right? Right. But you could imagine the encyclopedia of all games, you know, like it'd be 24 volumes on a shelf, alphabetically.
But there wouldn't be like, okay, so this game Bulletstorm, which is a semi-popular shooter that came out, but it's kind of obscure. Like there's no encyclopedia of Bulletstorm, right? There's no, like Call of Duty is like a whole thing. World of Warcraft is a whole thing.
World of Warcraft could have an encyclopedia.
Could be an encyclopedia.
Well, yeah.
I mean, what you guys are doing, which I think is really unique, is inviting your customers to participate in your customer segmentation process. This question of like what constitutes a segment and what constitutes a market, these conversations are normally happen in private, in secret in most companies, because they all have this problem. You want to put out a marketing message. You want to put it in the right magazines. You want to alienate just the right people. You want people to, you know, the right kind of people to resonate with your thing, and that necessarily excludes other people. Mm-hmm. And so that's usually a very secretive, very complicated, very messy process. And you guys, it's still complicated and messy, but you're also doing it in public, which I think is super cool.
Yeah, we don't necessarily have a good mechanism, though, of arriving at... I mean, we do it in public, but then we have to manually go and say, no, the guitar people have to be with the piano people. Like somebody has to do that. Like that we don't actually have an automatic mechanism by which the magically correct size sites fall out at the end.
You know, I had a thought, Joel, that one of the reasons that the subreddits can be smaller is because they're so conversational, whereas we suppress conversation. We're like, no, this is not a conversation.
Right.
This is serious business,
Q&A.
Right? We're here to learn facts about things. We're here to do science, basically.
We need more, so we need a larger.
That is a much harder thing to do. Like, I was thinking, okay, I got to ask a question about Battlefield on gaming, and I actually have some questions that I could ask that are completely legit, but... there's a bar. It's not just go in and just, oh, isn't it cool how you can vault over obstacles in Battlefield? And other people say, yes, that's very cool.
Yeah.
And here's a screenshot of me doing it. And on Reddit, that's perfectly acceptable. But on our site, that would be like closed, right?
Yeah.
So no, the reason we can't have...
strategy is about what you don't do, but what you refuse to do.
Right. Yeah. Well, of course. No. We're very strict about this for a reason, because we think the output creates this really useful artifact for everyone. If you can, again, the religion, right? You have to get the religion of we're here to do things that matter, right? That are going to produce useful artifacts for other people. And a discussion of how cool vaulting is, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a chat. It's not wrong, but it's not what we do.
You'd be happy to send people to Reddit to have that conversation.
Yeah, we do. I mean, I'm going to Reddit rather than gaming for a lot of the information I'm getting. I'm going to port some of it back over because I want to ask questions about it. But it's a different experience. It's interesting. It's really interesting to compare and contrast, because I had not spent a lot of time on subreddits.
Okay, enough about that. What else is new? Actually, I do. We're sort of running out of time. So, Eric, we traditionally talk about sort of news of Stack Overflow at the end of the call.
Cool.
So, and normally, see, when Jeff is not on vacation, he would be telling me all the cool stuff that he did this week. but now I have to tell him all the cool stuff I've been doing.
I bought a dishwasher.
You can tell me how it's going.
Yeah, and tell you how it's going.
Yeah.
I have decided to get deeply involved, not deeply involved. I have decided to attack the, we have this thing called a moderator queue, of flag queue, of things that that have been flagged by our users for moderators to look at and work on. It now has 244 things that we have to look at. And just because I'm a nerd, I'm also sort of analyzing every single thing that gets flagged in the system and why it got flagged and why all these people believe like they need to. Whoa, there's new stats there. Hey, those just arrived. That's like a brand new thing. Didn't Mark Rebell just do that? He did. Awesome.
I don't know.
Check it out, Jeff. Moderator flags.
I'm not allowed to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sorry.
To look at that stuff.
Okay.
Remember, you made my vacation. You just added like a week to my vacation.
He's trying to trick you, Jeff.
I'm sorry.
I won't listen to you, Joel. I won't listen to your lies.
So the moderator queue is large and painful and consists of many painful decisions that moderators have to make, which reminds me of something we mentioned last week, which is the Israeli parole boards that as time went on, they just sent more and more people to the electric chair.
Yeah.
later in the day it was, they're like, I'm kind of hungry, electric chair. Just because they were so sick and tired of making decisions that they started making, essentially they took the default decision, more frequently. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just hard to decide.
Another psychological bug.
Yeah. So, and one of the problems that we have essentially is that we're trying to create a site that moderates itself. And one of the ways we do that is we have elections and people become moderators and then they have to do some of this cleanup work. And I think there are a few flaws in that system. Mainly, one of the things that Jeff said to me, which sort of surprised me, is that one of the moderators does about half of the work on the site, which is a typical power curve thing. But if we could just get a couple more moderators to chip in, the amount of work would go down dramatically. So I've been sort of focusing on trying to figure out what the things are that come up frequently in moderation and what the common themes are. There's a couple of things that I've noticed. I've been talking to the core team about a little bit, and they're already starting to get fixed. One thing which I've noticed is that there's a tendency to pile on people that just don't speak English natively. Or to flag those things because you get angry with them and they sort of say, well, that's low quality. And usually it's a combination. It's usually either the person asking the question is not a native English speaker or the person answering the question is a relative beginner at programming.
Wait. You hold on.
But
are you sure
a combination
you're not
using, both.
Are you sure it's not the rose-colored glasses? I mean, did they put effort into the question? It's fine if the spelling is wrong and all that stuff, but did they put effort into their question? Because I want to be clear about that.
Sure. Yes, usually yes.
As long as they put effort in, because usually that comes along with no effort. It's really common.
And then you just say, okay, forget it. This is worthless.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If they've done the work, if they've contributed, if they've met us, 25 to 30% of the way, then fine.
That's actually kind of interesting because you just gave me a metric that I wasn't really aware of, that there's a simple formula. Like one of the problems with moderating is that it takes a long time to learn like what the consensus is on the site. And there are a few areas of ambiguity. So for example, people see homework questions and they flag them for moderators. And the moderators, I think, have different views probably on whether homework is acceptable or not. And so what that means is that it becomes a decision for the moderator when it probably doesn't have to. Like we could just say, you know what, the rule is homework's okay as long as you tag it homework, done. The end. Or whatever.
Effort still has to factor into it.
Okay, like, well then that
can
be the rule.
You can't just post your homework and say, solve my homework for me.
Yeah,
you have to say,
show what you did.
Here's what I tried to do.
Yeah.
Well, you need a policy that people can apply consistently.
Well, that's what it is. It's not even that they can apply consistently. It's that there's a lot of ambiguity. The decisions are kind of hard. And there are good answers, which you're giving me now, Jeff. And I know most of them. And you can figure them out. And you can browse meta and eventually learn them. And then it can become easier and easier to moderate. But some of those things are things where it's making the kind of the mental load on a newbie moderator so high that,
might even schedule a call with some of the really active moderators.
Yeah.
Actually, Joel, that might be a good idea for you. Schedule a call, maybe you, the community team, and sort of the most active moderators on Stack Overflow, because they're the ones, you know, really doing the work. So, And to be honest, like whenever I see a Meta, I don't go to Meta right now because I'm on Rum Springer, but when I see a request from a high-ranking moderator, it does get prioritized. Like I realize that these people are doing a lot to make our system work, and I do not take their requests lightly.
Sure.
And continuing in that trend, maybe, you know, have a call where people can just, you know,
one
sound
of the
off.
I'll give you another example.
Do moderators level up?
They're at the ultimate leveling up. That's as leveled up as they can get before we hire them.
There's no moderator. There's no levels of moderators.
There are. Basically 10,000 rep users start to have lots of moderation capabilities. As you work your way through the system, you start to get more and more abilities to do things which are kind of lightweight moderation abilities. Sometimes it might just be like voting on whether or not a question can be closed, and you earn the right to do that, I think, at 3,000. So as you pass certain point thresholds, you start to earn the right to do things. And you can earn most of the mod privs by 10,000, I think. And then there's a whole bunch of sort of more advanced stuff for when you actually get elected to be a moderator. And then, like I say, some of the moderators have been hired by the company and they work for us. Meta moderators, essentially, moderating the moderators.
Yeah.
So there is definitely this ascension and leveling up kind of concept, which is awesome and cool.
Well, but we also put the stats together, Joel. That's new. That came out in the last couple of months. Was for a long time you had no idea how much work
the moderators were doing.
There was no visibility really into it. You just did it or you didn't do it.
Yeah.
But we now when you go to the moderation page, there's sort of a page that just says, you know, here's what everybody did over the last week, month, quarter.
Day. Yeah. Yeah.
And you can sort of see because you know the point you're making that you know, one of the moderators was doing the lion's share of the work was
we hadn't noticed. Yeah.
Until 3 months ago.
So one of the, I'm trying to think of what the other things that I noticed were.
It's good to think about this because also to be clear, this is only really a problem on Stack Overflow.
Sure.
No other site, secondary sites, it's a non-issue. They get like 10, 20 flags a day. Who cares? It's easy. It's trivial.
Yep.
But this is very specific to Stack Overflow. I do think it helps all the sites, but I just want to be clear that like, there's some scaling thing that kicks in when you get to the enormous size of Stack Overflow that causes these particular problems. It's not normally an issue on any other site.
Right, right.
Doesn't make it a non-issue. It's still a serious problem, of course. But
hopefully your Stack Overflow is the canary that will tell you where everything else is headed so you can be ready for it.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, if you do a graph line to see how long it's going to take super users to get to
the site. It might be 8 years.
I'm not sure I'll be alive then. Those sites are great. Don't get me wrong; they're doing really, really well. But like, there's this thing of like the blockbuster. It's like in you know pharmaceutical companies, they have the one blockbuster drug that makes billions of dollars, and then they just have everything else, right? It's kind of like that. But you still want to diversify. You don't want to be you know the company that has just one site, and that's a large reason we're doing what we're doing. Also because you know I legitimately want to improve the quality of information on the internet. But there is, if you look at the stats, you can go to stackexchange.com sites. It's pretty staggering if you run the numbers of our largest site versus all the other sites combined.
So, Jeff, tell me what you think about this. One of the things that we had, a frequent flag that I was seeing was not a real answer. And there are several common reasons why something is not a real answer. The first is that it should be a comment and should have been converted to a comment. Another one is that it's a me too. And a third one is it's just kind of random conversation. But at the time of the flag, we don't really capture that knowledge. So the mod has to basically decide, am I going to change this to a comment? Am I going to delete it? Or most likely you're just going to delete it, right? Because you're lazy. Or am I going to, try to figure it out by reading the whole post and figuring out where it goes and blah, blah, blah. So one of the things I was thinking of is if you make that something that the flagger, has to or optionally can include in their flag, like I would like to flag this, then essentially you're telling the flagger, all right, give me your prescription. And then all I have to do is check it to see if it's right. I don't have to decide. I just have to check.
No, yes, I think indeed, that's a great idea. That's a great idea because basically you're just moving friction from the moderators who have a ton of friction already to the
community.
People flagging.
Yeah,
I think is fine. Just avoid the 10,000 bulleted list phenomenon of like, here's the 20 reasons you could flag this post. Like, I don't want it
can be optional. It can be optional, but it's just it just if you look at the people that are flagging, actually, which I do a lot of to see who they are, sometimes it's a drive-by flagger, but a lot of it, they're people that are trying to improve their flag weight, and they're doing this as an activity because we have this additional game that we made up called Flag Weight. And that those group of people, if you give them shit to do, they'll do it. Like, you know, they're happy to do stuff for us. And so that's kind of an opportunity to move some of the cognitive pain from the moderators onto, you know, to spread it out.
So probably what I would recommend there is just have a drop down. I would actually make it mandatory. I think you should have to make that decision because we do want to move some of the weight of flagging off the moderators onto the community. And if you're gonna flag something, you should have a reason, like a detailed reason of why you flag this. And that I think the logic is completely sound. Just avoid adding any more radio buttons.
More than 16. The other thing,
more than 25 radio buttons is probably too many.
Yeah. Well, I keep coming back to there's certain things where. This is sort of another theme, is that things get flagged, they show up to moderators right away, but sometimes they cure themselves because the users then have a conversation in the comments and they go back and they fix their question to make it be, you know, off topic doesn't cure itself, but it show me some sample code and then it gets flagged as low quality and then they add the sample code and now it's a good question. So you can just clear those, but you almost want to give them an hour or so to try to clear themselves first before a moderator spends time thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, but if it's something more urgent.
Well, if it's urgent, then it's urgent. Then that's like spam or, I mean, but these things are
Those are pretty rare.
Yeah.
That's true.
One of the things that we did for moderation at InView was we had a system where basically like multiple lower level moderators would all be asked the same to weigh in. And if everybody agreed, it would just be closed out the way they thought and it would only be escalated to a higher level person if they didn't agree.
We have a little bit of that, but not enough. We could do more of that. Like if we have three people flagging something as a Me Too answer, just automatic, you know, as long as their flag weight is high enough and it doesn't have any upvotes, we can just automatically delete it before we show it. And we don't even have to show it to a moderator until there's, you know, maybe two flags or...
I support that as long as there's a minimum flag weight,
you know,
like if it's, say, three people, different people, and they have a minimum flag weight, I could support that.
We
and
have
it's not
loads
like
of heuristics.
An invasive one.
Yeah.
But because... even what you want is for, you want basically to be able to train your junior moderators to learn the tastes of the senior moderators so that the senior moderators aren't doing all the work.
Exactly. And that's actually kind of hard to learn. And we were talking about that earlier today. We don't have that official way of doing that. And I pushed some wrong button when I was learning how to moderate and all the people yelled at me in the meta. and it's very hard for me. I mean, I can look at, and there's ways of doing that. Like I can sit there and I can watch what our top moderators who are right now, Bill the Lizard and Tim Post, I can watch what they're doing and try to learn how to moderate from what they've done. But in some areas, I don't completely agree with them, actually. I'm more of a libertarian as to what I think can be should be.
Well, as long as you're willing to do the work. See, this is the problem. It's like, okay, yeah, if you, Joel Spolsky, are going to sit down and rewrite all these bad posts for 6 hours, sure. Awesome. Go for it.
Go for it. Well, that's one of the things is I want to say to people, like sometimes people flag something and they say, this is not a good question. And I'll just reject it saying the only problem with this question is that the English is not grammatical. So just fix it. Don't waste my time, please. Like, that's sort of my attitude towards it.
It's not really, I think, okay.
No, but it's a good question that we want to be there. It's a.
You need to make a case that it's a good question. I mean, most of the time when I see this, I would say 90% of the time or more,
it's not a good enough question.
It needs to be a good question. I mean, you have to put, where's the burden? We're talking about moving the friction around in the system.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the friction, honestly, is on the person asking.
Yeah,
the other thing
I think would be neat to do is to have, we have vote to close, but there could be, I still feel like there's another kind of limbo other than close. Close just feels sort of permanent to people, even though we know it's not. Like, I want to say, imagine this. Imagine that you could flag something as not a good question, and then you could check off reasons, and you might say, need sample code, or your English sucks, or there's too much code. You didn't, you know, minimize, you just pasted your entire project file into project directory into here. Or you didn't do enough work, or I don't even understand what you're asking here. And if it gets two or three of those flags from people with a high enough weight, the question is hidden. Nobody can see it. Nobody knows about it. And it's going to get deleted or closed in a month. And you have a chance as the person asking the question, or you have an obligation, a burden to fix it.
I don't know. You got to be careful there because really, the volume of questions we get on Stack Overflow, it's okay to throw 10% of them away. 10% of them probably should be thrown away, to be perfectly honest with you. Because you're getting, let me expand this. How many questions per day now?
4,000 questions per day. How many of those 4,000 do you think really needed to be asked and were actually worthy of being asked? Now, there's two arguments for me. One is, okay, first, it's a long tail problem. I was going to tell Eric about this. The reason we don't have enough flagging and enough voting is because not enough people at the volume that we have are looking at your post. So there's not enough signal. There's not enough people that see it and are willing to click flag or vote.
Yeah, that's a good
or can even have the ability to do that because voting requires 15 rep, flagging requires 15 rep, downvoting requires 125 rep. So every time, my feeling is, Joel, every time you get that little bit of signal, somebody felt pretty strongly because clicking flag takes effort. You have to think. You're like, okay, I'm flagging. Then you have to pick a reason for flagging, maybe even a sub-reason.
Yeah.
Like people just don't do that because they're bored. Yes, they want flag weight, but generally they do it. Like whenever I see flags, it's so rare to see a flag that was just, okay, I was bored and I clicked flag. I mean, I can probably count on one hand the number of times I've seen a flag where I was like, I had no idea why it was flagged. Like usually when there's a flag, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's something wrong there. People aren't just doing this out of boredom because the path of least resistance is to do nothing and just let the questions fall away into the distance, right? Nobody looks at it. Nobody cares. It never gets answered. Maybe that's the correct outcome, Joel. Mm-hmm. Maybe for some of these questions, it's not that they need to be fixed. They just need to
die.
Quietly go away.
Yeah, yeah. We actually, that sort of leads to, well, okay, I got a whole bunch of things. I could talk about this for days, but we're kind of out of time and Eric has to go. But that was enough about flagging. We'll talk about that more in the future.
Well, it's good that you're looking at this because it's a big problem on Stack Overflow. It's just the scale. It's so hard to deal with.
Don't worry. I'll go get it all fixed up for you.
Eric, nobody on vacation should be thinking about it.
Your book is number one on the New York Times bestseller list. I don't know if that's true, but I'm going to say that it is.
Oh my God, I got to buy this book.
Bestseller.
Everyone's got to buy the book ASAP. It actually peaked at number two while we're being accurate.
That's pretty friggin' impressive for a computer book.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Sorry, I know it's not a computer book. Lean Startup by Eric Ries, who is also Eric Ries, R-I-E-S, on the Twitter, at E-R-I, Eric with a C. There's so many different ways your name could be spelled.
It is, yes.
It could be R-U-I-Z, for example. But it's not. Where's your website?
TheLeanStartup.com.
TheLeanStartup. What? I hope Lean Startup isn't something about meat.
Probably is. God only knows.
TheLeanStartup.com. Eric Ries, thank you for being with us. Podcast number
24.
And next week we have Mark Rusinovich. Is that how you pronounce it?
Rusinovich next week.
Nice. Awesome.
The people, the hardcore programmers know who that is.
Yeah, Jeff has been begging for Mark.
Maybe
for
we can get
weeks.
Him to fix our stupid garbage collection problem, or is he too low level?
I have a total man crush on Mark Rusinovich. He's so awesome.
so that'll be next week, and we'll see you then.
All right.
Okay.
Bye, everyone.
Take care, guys.